Welcome to Readsy Live, the podcast. I'm your host, Martin Kavanagh. In this show, I speak with professionals from the world of publishing to show you how to write and publish better books. Today, I'm sharing a talk from author Jessica Brody about the Save the Cat story method. Jessica is the author of over 20 novels written for teens, tweens, and adults, including The Chaos of Standing Still and The Unremembered trilogy. She has also written the number one best-selling plotting guide for novelists titled Save the Cat Writes a Novel. Her books have now been translated into over 20 languages. This conversation was recorded in April 2023 and live-streamed on Readsy's YouTube channel. So let's drop in with Jessica Brody and learn how to save the cat.
All right, everyone. Welcome, welcome, welcome to this special presentation on an introduction to the Save the Cat method for novelists. Let's dive in. We have a lot to cover today. Today, what I'm going to talk about is I'm going to teach you how the Save the Cat method can help you outline, write, draft, revise, and fix your novel, any genre of novel. If you are not familiar with the Save the Cat method, this is a great crash course to get you up and running. You'll be able to use everything you learn today right away. If you're already familiar with the method, great. This is also a great refresher to kind of give you a look at the method through some new eyes. I might say something, describe something in a new way that you haven't heard before. So it's also great for people already familiar with it. Before I get started, I just want to give you a quick overview of how I got into the seat today and why I'm talking to you today. So I want to flash back to about a little over 15 years ago, trying and failing to get my first manuscript represented by an agent. So I wanted to go that traditional publishing route, get the agent, sell the novel to a major publisher, and I kept getting rejected over and over again. But the strange thing was, is there was a theme throughout my rejection letters. There was a common thread, and they all seemed to say a similar thing, which is, you're a good writer, but you don't know how to tell a story, or there's no story here. And this really confused me. How can you be a good writer without knowing how to tell a story? I thought the two things went together. They really don't. And what I learned very quickly is that I didn't know what a story was. I didn't know how to structure one. I didn't know what it entailed. And that became clear when I was introduced to this book called Save the Cat. It was a screenwriting guide originally written by Blake Snyder, a screenwriter. And it broke down screenplays into these 15 beats, or like a blueprint that you could follow. But what I found when I read this book was that these 15 beats didn't just apply to screenplays, they applied to stories in general. And I thought, what if I took these 15 beats and applied it to the novel that I was trying to get published? Well, that became my first experiment with the Save the Cat method. I ended up rewriting my entire novel using this method that Blake Snyder laid out for screenwriters. I rewrote the novel. I ended up getting an agent for that rewrite. The agent sold it to a major publisher, St. Martin's Press, and I ended up selling over 20 novels to major publishers over the next 15 years using this very method. And I sold these to publishers like Simon & Schuster, Penguin Random House, Macmillan. So I'd like to think that the method works. But then I had this question of, does it just work for me? Do I just kind of happen to write the kinds of books that sort of feel like movies? So I set out to experiment again with the method. Does this method apply to all novels, to all stories? And my research led me to write a book called Save the Cat Writes a Novel, in which I take the original screenwriting method and I apply it to novels. So here's what I found when I was researching this book, Save the Cat Writes a Novel. I read a ton of different novels. I read novels from mystery novels like The Girl on the Train, modern mysteries like The Girl on the Train. I read horror like Stephen King's Misery. I read young adult romance like Everything Everything, middle grade fantasy like Percy Jackson, and even classics like The Grapes of Wrath and earlier. And I found that hidden inside all of these books, there was this sort of code. And here's what I found. I found that about 10% of the way through all of these stories, there was this big life-changing event, something that kind of stopped the main character in their tracks and forced them to think about life differently. I found that around 20% of the way through all of these stories, that same main character, that hero, decided to try something new or go somewhere new. I found that around 50% of the way through all of these stories, there was a major turning point that completely changed the direction of the plot. And I found that around 75% of the way through all these stories, there was a rock bottom moment. And around 80 to 85% of the way through all of these stories, there was another moment of discovery where the hero found a resolution. Now, that's either a really strange coincidence, or I stumbled upon something interesting, which I call the secret storytelling code. It's this pattern that exists within all stories. Blake Snyder found it in screenplays. I found it in novels. Blake Snyder just gave these beats different names. He called them things like the catalyst, the break into two, the midpoint, the all is lost, the break into three. And these points, these are five of the 15 beats or plot points that we're going to talk about today. They can be found in all great stories, screenplays, and novels alike. So what exactly is the Save the Cat method? It's a structure blueprint. It's a series of plot points that can be found in every great story ever told. But I like to think of it a little differently. I like to think of it as a transformation machine, which means an imperfect hero goes into this thing that we're going to call the beat sheet or the outline of the novel, and a less imperfect hero comes out. It's essentially a method that helps you track a compelling character arc across an entire story. The Save the Cat beat sheet is basically at the heart of the method, and it is a three-act structure that has been broken down even further into these 15 beats or plot points that we're going to talk about today. So these are things that are going to make your story more compelling, help with the pacing, hold your reader's attention, and leave your reader feeling satisfied. You might be thinking, okay, but is this just for outlining a novel? Like, is this just when people start writing and you want to plot out what happens? Although the Save the Cat method is really great for outlining or fleshing out a new idea, it's actually also good for a lot of other things, like maybe test driving a new idea. Before you start writing, you might ask yourself, how many beats can I instantly come up with or just come up with rough ideas for, even if they change later on? If you can come up with ideas for beats right away, you know that the story can go the distance. It's also great for figuring out what's broken in a story. It's an excellent diagnostic tool for looking at a story you're already working on and realizing where you've gone astray or maybe where your story could be more impactful. It's also an excellent tool for revising an existing story. Maybe you have a first draft that you drafted really quickly, or it was a discovery draft, and now you have a bunch of scenes and a bunch of things that you need to figure out how to make it work. If you compare what you have to this Save the Cat beat sheet, you can easily see what needs to be revised, what needs to be moved around, what can be cut, and what needs to be added. It's also a really good tool for getting back on track after you've wandered, 300 miles off the course of your current story, which I've definitely done, and I know a lot of writers have too. Okay, but why is it called Save the Cat? If you signed up for this webinar thinking it was about saving cats, like rescuing them, you might be disappointed. It's not really what it's about, although that is a very worthy cause and you should rescue cats. But this is a little different. So Save the Cat simply refers to the moment in a story when a hero does something redeeming. Or you could think of it as the moment when the audience or the reader gets behind the hero of your story. So Blake Snyder called it the Save the Cat moment because it's the moment where the hero saves a cat, like from a burning tree or a burning house or a tree or a shelter. But it's not you don't literally have to save a cat. It's just a metaphor for something that the hero does that is redeeming. One of my favorite examples of a Save the Cat moment is from the movie Aladdin. Aladdin is seen at the beginning stealing a loaf of bread. He's chased through the marketplace. He wreaks all sorts of havoc. And then what does he do? He gives the bread to a starving mother and child. And suddenly we are on Aladdin's side. He has been redeemed and we are following him through the whole story. So that's what the Save the Cat, where Save the Cat comes from. All right, so here's how we're going to go through the Save the Cat method today. First, I'm going to give you a quick introduction of all 15 beats. So we're going to go pretty quickly because there's a lot to cover. What I'm going to do is I'm going to use a beat sheet or an example of a popular novel to show you each of those 15 beats. And then afterwards, we're going to put it all together with a whole nother example, and you're going to see the beat sheet in action from start to finish. So the book that we're going to cover first is called The Girl on the Train. If you haven't read it, I'm sorry, there will be spoilers in this presentation, but I figured this book's been out long enough, you can be spoiled. All right, so we're in our first beat, the opening image. This is where we're going to set the tone, style, and mood of the story. It's essentially a before snapshot of who your flawed main character is at the start of the story. And from here on out, we're going to call your main character the hero. So essentially, it's a starting point of their transformation. Remember, this is a transformation machine. So where are they before they go into the machine? And how is their life or their world flawed? Essentially, we want to show who your hero is and what their life is like. And we get one image to really give the reader that first glimpse or that first impression. So if you are doing world building, this is also where we're going to get the first glimpse of your hero's world. Now, it's called the opening image and not the opening monologue or the opening info dump because it works best when it's visual and when we see the hero interacting with their world. That is the best way to engage your reader right off the bat, is to drop them into an active scene and show who this hero is and what their life is like. All right, so when we look at our example, the girl on the train, we see in the opening image that Rachel is riding a train, fantasizing about other people's lives. So what does this tell us? Well, it gives us a sense that, one, this is a very regular occurrence for her, and also that she fantasizes about things a lot, that maybe she doesn't actually live in the real world, she prefers to live in her head. And that is a quick glimpse of a flaw that's going to play out throughout the rest of the story. All right, now we get into the setup. As you can see, this is a multi-scene beat. It spans 1 to 10% of your novel, so it is multiple scenes or chapters in which a lot of important things are happening. These are scenes that we're going to use to explore the hero's status quo life, so their life before the transformation begins, and all of its flaws. The flaws are the important part. We want to show how our hero's life is problematic. So what does your hero's life look like before that epic transformation? The opening image gave us our first taste. This is where we get to explore it more. If you're going to include a save the cat moment, this is where you might put it in the setup. And this is also where we're going to introduce other supporting characters in the story. And also, super important, we're going to introduce our hero's primary goal here. This is something external or tangible that the hero is pursuing. We also can call these the wants. Now, it's important for your hero to be pursuing something at the start of the story. Nothing turns off a reader than the heroes is just sitting around waiting for something to happen to them. We want our hero to be actively doing something at the start. Also, giving them something to pursue not only puts them in motion, which is one of the most active ways you can engage a reader, is to have a hero in motion. It also tells us a little bit something about your hero by what it tells us what they want. It doesn't have to be what they want throughout the entire story. Goals will often change, and I'm going to point out places where those goals will often change, but giving your hero a goal from the start is an instant way to engage your reader. This is also a chance to show more of your world if you're doing some world building here. But essentially, what the setup boils down to is it's demonstrating why this hero or this world needs to change. We're creating a sense of urgency for our reader. Our reader is going to be asking at the beginning, why are we here? Why do I need to read this story? And we answer that question by showing why this hero is flawed, why they need change in their life. That creates that urgency that the reader will want to keep reading to find out if that change occurs. Also, at the same time, we're hinting at the stakes should the hero not change, which again helps with that urgency of this story. In The Girl on the Train, the setup is basically we learn that Rachel has a drinking problem and often blacks out. So we know now she's an unreliable narrator. She can't get over her ex-husband, Tom, and she's recently lost her job. She rides that train every day looking for glimpses of Jess and Jason, whom she thinks has the perfect marriage. This is this fantasy couple that she wants to see every day. That's that goal she's pursuing. And her roommate is getting tired of her drinking and might kick her out if it continues. So now we've got some stakes. We see Rachel's life is a mess, and if it doesn't change, she's going to be out on the street. So we feel that urgency in the setup. 5% of the way through, we want to have this beat called the theme stated. The theme stated is essentially a statement that is subtly made by usually a secondary character that hints at what the hero's arc or transformation will be. So essentially, what does your hero need to learn or discover or overcome by the end of the story? How are they going to transform along this transformation machine? We like to plant that as a little subtle hint or a little seed in the reader's mind right at the beginning of the story. It's not obvious, it's not over the top, it's subtle, so that when you do deliver on that transformation by the end, the reader subconsciously feels like they've gone on this very exciting journey, that they somehow knew what it was about, but maybe not consciously. So it's usually related, the theme state is usually related to a flaw that the hero has to overcome, or maybe a fear they have to conquer. We can also call the theme stated the life lesson. What does your hero need to learn in order to fix their life throughout this story? In The Girl on the Train, we see this actually coming, I think it's on the first or second page. And Rachel narrates, "My mother used to tell me that I had an overactive imagination. Tom said that too." How do you like that? Rachel needs to learn how to face reality. We already saw her with her overactive imagination, and now we're planting that seed that is going to be the problem that she has to overcome by the end in order to truly fix her life. And actually, not surprisingly, it's the problem she has to overcome to solve the mystery as well. All right. Can't stay in the setup forever. Eventually, we're going to have to move on. And the way we move on is by throwing in a catalyst. Single scene that comes at around 10%, which is an inciting incident or life-changing event that is essentially going to catapult the hero into a new world or a new way of thinking. So it's an action beat that needs to be big enough to break the hero from their status quo life and keep them from returning to that life. If your hero can convincingly go back to the way things were after the catalyst, your catalyst is probably not big enough because you risk your reader asking, why don't they just go back to their old life? What's really compelling them to change? So we want to make sure that this action beat is big enough. That's why you'll often see at the catalyst common things like breakups, deaths, firings, attacks. Those are things that are very hard to come back from or very hard to return to normal life after those have happened. You'll also see invitations happen here, like an invitation to appear at or compete in some sort of event or a tournament. In The Girl on the Train, the catalyst comes when Rachel blacks out and wakes up with bruises, a bump on her head, and blood in her hair. She's unable to remember what happened the night before, but she thinks she remembers seeing Jess, the fantasy Jess, whose real name is actually Megan, kissing another man and getting angry about it. Huh. It's kind of hard to go back to your status quo life after you might have injured someone or harmed someone and you don't remember. So that's a really effective catalyst right there. It's also the start of the mystery. All right, the catalyst bumps us into a multi-scene beat called the debate, roughly 10% of your novel, and it takes us to the end of Act One. These are multiple scenes or chapters where your hero has a chance to essentially react to the catalyst. Something big just happened. They need time to process it. So really what's happening here is the hero is debating what to do next. And it's usually presented in the form of a question. That doesn't mean there will be a question on the page, or there could be, but if you summed up these scenes, they would sum up into a kind of question, like, should I go? What do I do? Am I ready? What does this mean? Those kinds of things, because the hero is essentially processing what just happened at the catalyst. We also sometimes see this as a preparation section. Maybe the hero knows exactly what to do next after the catalyst, but we want to give them time to prepare, maybe mentally, maybe physically, maybe emotionally. And we do that to help inform the reader that the next thing that they're about to do, this upcoming change, is big. It requires preparation. So the purpose of this beat is to either show how reluctant your hero is to change, or perhaps just make that upcoming decision feel believably momentous by having the hero prepare for it. So in The Girl on the Train, the question that sums up the debate scenes are, what happened on Saturday night? And what will Rachel do about it? So in this section where she's debating this, we also learn that Megan Hipwell, the woman that she remembers seeing in her blacked out state, is missing. So that kind of gives us a little bit more information to go on before we go into Act Two. So the break into two, we are now at the threshold between Act One and Act Two. A single scene beat that comes around the 20% mark is going to transition us into the second act. This is a moment when the hero decides to either accept a call to action, leave their comfort zone, try something new, venture into a new world or new way of thinking, or maybe all of the above. But the underlying theme here is new. Break Into Two is bringing us into a new world, a new part of the story. The more you can make your second act feel new, the more your reader will feel like they're going somewhere, like things are happening in this story. So essentially, this is a proactive beat that separates the status quo world of Act One from the new upside down world of Act Two. And I call it the upside down world, not because things literally have to be upside down. We don't all have to write Alice in Wonderland, but essentially because we want to remember that this should feel different. It should feel foreign. Your hero should feel like a fish out of water in Act Two, because that's going to give your story momentum. Now, this is often where we'll see a new or modified goal introduced. So maybe the Act 1 goal is going to continue through Act 2, but because that catalyst broke through the status quo world, it's quite believable that status quo goal might change as well. So often at the break into two, we'll see a new goal introduced, something the hero will pursue throughout at least the first half of Act 2. So in The Girl on the Train, we see the break into two is Rachel essentially decides to insert herself into the case. She thinks she has information that the police need. She thinks she's valuable to this missing persons case. So she vows to help solve the mystery of the missing Megan Hipwell, and that becomes her new goal. All right, once we're in Act Two, it's time to introduce a new character. We call this character the B-story character. So it's a single scene beat right after the break into two, somewhere within the beginning of Act Two, where we introduce a new character who will ultimately help the hero learn their theme or that life lesson. So what does your hero need to do to transform by the end? In some way, this B-story character is going to represent that journey, represent that theme, or help the hero learn it. And so this character essentially represents what we call the B story. In Save the Cat terms, the B story is the internal story of the novel. The external story is all the stuff going on outside of your hero, all of the plot points that you're throwing at your hero. The internal story is how those external plot points are affecting your hero inside, how it's affecting their psyche, how it's making them or forcing them to transform. That is what we call the internal story. So we bring a character in to help represent that internal story, to bring that internal story out of your character's head, out of their psyche, and onto the page. So this character can come in lots of different forms. It can be a love interest, a mentor, a friend, a nemesis, a sidekick, or something else. But the key is that they somehow represent that internal journey that the hero is on by maybe either representing the flaw that the hero has, maybe representing the life lesson that the hero needs to learn. Now, a question I get asked a lot is, can I have more than one B story character? Absolutely, you can, but you want to make sure that those B story characters, if you have more than one, that they represent the theme in different ways, or they teach the hero the theme coming from a different angle. Otherwise, you run the question of, why do I need both? And both characters will start to feel redundant. So actually, The Girl on the Train does have two B story characters. Rachel's theme, remember, is facing reality, getting out of her imagination, and it's represented by two different characters in the novel. The first is Scott Hipwell, the missing Megan's husband. Now, remember, he started out as part of that fantasy couple, and his name was Jason. His real name is Scott Hipwell. Now, he starts out as a love interest, but he turns out to be very different than the Jason that Rachel imagined. He's a much darker person than she envisioned. So that's interesting that we're representing her facing reality by creating a character that is nothing like the character that Rachel imagined. That's how he's representing that theme. On the other hand, we have Anna, who is Rachel's ex-husband's current wife, and she represents Rachel's painful past. So she is the new wife. She represents that past that Rachel is trying to overcome. Two characters representing the theme in different ways. All right, now we're in the heart of Act Two. We call it the fun and games. It is the longest beat of the entire novel. Multiple scenes start spanning 20% to 50% of your novel. This is essentially a sequence of scenes or chapters where the hero navigates their new world. So we ask ourselves, how are they faring? Are they loving it? Hating it, succeeding, floundering. We also see them pursuing their Act Two goal, and we can ask ourselves, are they making strides to achieve it, or are they struggling to achieve it? This beat can also be called the promise of the premise, because essentially any premise of any story is really just boils down to an Act One hero in an Act Two world. And when we make that Act Two world different enough, putting an Act One hero into it, immediately sparks are going to fly. Immediately, we're going to have juxtaposition. Immediately, we're going to have conflict. We're going to have fun. And that's where the term fun and games really comes from. And that's what your premise is. So that's why I urge you to make that fun, that Act Two world different enough so that your premise really shines. We can also call this the hook of the novel. Why the reader picked up the novel in the first place. They want to read about an Act One hero in an Act Two world. Now, it's important to note that this beat might just be only fun for the reader. It might not be fun for the hero. It doesn't mean that the hero has to be having fun here, as we're going to see in an example coming up later, where the fun in games is very, very far from fun. But it's fun for the reader because they're seeing that juxtaposition. They're seeing that Act One hero in the Act Two world. So in The Girl on the Train, actually, Rachel has a lot of fun in the fun and games. She's investigating. She's playing detective. She's having a blast. She researches. She creates theories. She meets with Scott. She tips off the police about Megan kissing another man. She's really having a good time here. She even quits drinking and seems to be making strides towards solving the case. She is definitely succeeding in her fun and games. She's actually having fun and seemingly succeeding at her goal. The fun and games culminates at a beat called the midpoint. It is a single scene beat that happens 50% of the way through the story, which is literally the middle of the novel. And it culminates, the fun and games culminates in either a false victory, meaning the hero has thus far been succeeding and or has achieved their goal, or maybe has come close to achieving their goal, or has achieved some big part of their goal. Or perhaps it's a false defeat, in which the hero has thus far been floundering in the fun and games, and or has not achieved their goal, or has maybe lost a big part of their goal. Either way, something needs to happen here at the midpoint that's going to raise the stakes of the story and push the story in a new direction. So some popular choices in order to shift the direction of the plot. We see a lot of plot twists happen here. Definitely shifts the direction of the plot by revealing some kind of surprise. We'll see ticking clocks appear here. If this doesn't happen by this time, X, Y, Z will happen. We see shocking reveals happen here. We see the love story ramp up here. It's sometimes hard to go back to who they were before once that love story ramps up. So something big should happen at the midpoint that's essentially going to shift that direction of the plot. Because what we want here is we want to push the hero out of the fun and games into the next beat and ultimately toward real change. So this midpoint really needs to feel like it's no longer fun and games anymore. Things are starting to get serious. And we see that play out really well in The Girl on the Train. The main suspect, Kamal, is arrested. So we have a false victory. Rachel thinks she solved the case. She got the main suspect arrested. But soon after, he's released, which proves that the victory was false. And then, to raise the stakes, turn the story in a new direction, Megan's body is found, upgrading this case to a murder investigation. It's no longer fun and games. Rachel's not just playing detective anymore. Now a woman is dead. That's a great example of stakes being raised at the midpoint. All right, once we've shifted the direction of the plot, we are in a brand new beat and a brand new direction. It is called The Bad Guys Close In. It's a multi-scene beat that spans 25% of the novel. And essentially, you can figure out what direction your Bad Guys Close In is going to take based on your midpoint. If your midpoint was a false victory, then this will be a downward path where things get progressively worse for your hero. Because remember, we want to shift the direction of the plot so that it doesn't feel stagnant. On the other hand, if your midpoint was a false defeat, a false low, then this will feel like an upward path where things get progressively better for your hero. And we're going to see an example of this coming up next. But regardless of path, this is the beat where stakes and tension and conflict are heightened. We really want to feel like the heroes, the walls are closing in on your hero. It's a claustrophobic beat. It's where things are feeling tighter and tighter. You could also call it the conflict closes in. If you don't have real bad guys, you can throw conflict at your hero. But really, every hero has a kind of bad guys that we call the internal bad guys. These are your hero's flaws, those things that they haven't quite transformed out of yet, those things that they haven't fully conquered. They are putting more and more pressure on your hero to change internally as well. So a lot of things are closing in here in this beat. Now, because the midpoint changed the direction of the plot, we will often see a new or modified goal being introduced at the bad guys close in. The hero is heading in a new direction. There's a chance that they might have a new goal with that new direction. In The Girl on the Train, things get progressively worse for Rachel as she loses herself in the investigation. She starts seeing Megan's therapist, whom she thinks Megan's was having an affair with. She sleeps with Megan's husband, Scott, in an attempt to get closer to this imaginary Jason. So she's still kind of pursuing that fantasy life of hers. And she starts to remember things from the night of Megan's disappearance, and she starts to drink again. So then we see those flaws coming back, those internal bad guys closing in. Now, regardless if you're on an upward or a downward path in your fun and games, all paths lead to the all is lost. A single scene beat around 3/4 of the way through your novel, which basically marks the lowest point of the story. This is an action beat where something will happen to the hero that pushes them to rock bottom. So there's often a sense of failure to achieve a goal here, or something is lost that's important to the hero. That's where we get that title, All is Lost. We want to make sure that the hero really has failed in some way here or lost something. And that's also why this beat will often include what's called a whiff of death. So maybe something literally dies here. Maybe a mentor dies here. Maybe a pet dies here. Maybe a family member dies here. Or you can also have a metaphorical death. Maybe a relationship dies here. Maybe an idea or a partnership or a friendship dies here. And the reason we insert the whiff of death is not because we're callous authors who just like to put in death because it works and we're trying to manipulate the reader. No, because actually what death does is it symbolizes the death of the old hero. Something has to die, something has to give so that the new hero, the transformed hero, can be reborn. So we insert something that dies here in order to symbolize that transition out of the old hero and into the new hero, which is coming up soon. So that's what we use the whiff of death for. In The Girl on the Train, at this moment, Scott finds out that Rachel has been lying to him and locks her up, threatening to kill her. So there we see our whiff of death. It seems like she's completely lost her goal here of solving this mystery because she's locked up in this closet. And also she discovers that Megan was pregnant when she died and the baby wasn't Scott's or Kamal's. So her two main suspects are now out of the game, out of the running. She has essentially failed at this point. The all is lost is the low point, but then the hero has a chance to wallow in it. They have a chance to basically react once again to this thing that has happened to them. So this is another reaction beat, multiple scenes, 75 to 80% of your novel, where the hero takes time to process what's happened. If that sounds like the debate, it's very similar. It's similar to what happened after the catalyst. We give our hero time to process. I like to call it the wallowing beat because heroes often wallow here, or they grieve, or they mourn, or maybe they get angry and rant and throw things. But essentially, the hero should be worse off here than anywhere else in the novel because they've tried and they've failed, and now they get a chance to really wallow in that failure. Now, it feels like the darkest hour, but remember, we're not just bringing them low just because it works. We are doing something very symbolic here. This is the darkness before the dawn. This is the gestation period of that new hero who's going to be reborn. This dark night of the soul is necessary for the hero to dig deep down and find the solution that they need to break into Act 3 coming up next. So that's why this beat will often include a dark night epiphany, some sort of final clue or piece of information or new way of looking at things falls into place, or the hero has some sort of life-changing aha realization that's going to lead to their next decision. So in The Girl on the Train, we see Rachel drinking herself into a stupor. So she's back to her old ways, and now she's even worse off than she was before. She tries to tell the police about Scott, but she's turned away. They don't believe her anymore. And then she finally confronts a man from her memories of that that night, and he gives her a very key piece of information about what happened. So in her darkness, she goes back into something that's scary. She goes to confront this man, and that's where she finds the peace that she needs. So the dark night of the soul, the dark night epiphany, leads to an aha moment and a solution. The break into three is the threshold between act two and act three, comes around 80%. It's one scene in which the hero realizes what they need to do. You could also call it a breakthrough moment. So in this realization, they are coming up with some sort of plan to fix all of the problems from act two, and maybe more important, to fix themselves. So our character arc is nearly complete now. The character knows what they need to do. They know how to overcome their flaws. They know how to fix the messes they've made. But now we need to see them actually doing it. And that's what the next beat is going to be about. You'll find the break into three will often come with a modified goal or a new plan. We call it the Act Three goal. It's the thing they're going to pursue throughout Act Three. So in The Girl on the Train, by confronting her past and facing that reality, which is her theme, Rachel realizes that Tom has been lying to her and manipulating her for a long time. So what does she do? She gets on a train, aha, and goes to rescue Anna, her B-story character, from Tom, which is her Act 3 goal. So that brings us into the finale. As I said, the break into three is the decision to act. Now we get the implementation. And that's what we see throughout this beat called the finale, a multi-scene beat that's going to bring us to the end of the novel, the last 20% of your story, where the hero must prove that they really have learned the theme by enacting their Act Three plan or goal and proving that they have what it takes. That's why we don't make it easy for them. We throw lots of conflict at them, but this is where we're going to see those bad guys being destroyed, those flaws being conquered, hostages are rescued, lovers are reunited, whatever else you've dreamed up for your big Act Three finale. Sometimes the help of the B-story character is brought in here if the B-story character, you know, survived after the all is lost whiff of death. And it's important to note that the finale should never feel easy. It should feel like a test. Because it is. We are testing the hero. Do you really have what it takes to conquer this flaw? We know that you know what to do. Can you actually do it? So we throw lots of conflict in. And that's why it's often called the climax of the story. By the end, not only is the hero's world saved, it's usually a better place than it was before. I say usually because not all books have to have a happy ending. You might not choose to have a happy ending, but your story needs to go somewhere. And that's what the finale is, really wrapping up that journey. In The Girl on the Train, we see together with Anna, Rachel confronts and brings down Tom for the murder of Megan Hipwell. And when Tom tries to kill Rachel, she symbolically stabs him with a corkscrew, the symbol of her drinking, the flaw, overcoming the flaw and the past and all the things. It's all coming together in this beat. That brings us to our final scene of the novel, 100% single scene beat, where we have, ta-da, an after snapshot of your hero. Remember, the opening image was the before snapshot? Now your hero has gone through the transformation machine. What do they look like when they come out the other end? That's what we snap here in this snapshot. So it is an end point of their transformation, and it shows who the hero is after their exciting journey has changed them. Now, once again, like the opening image, it works best when it's visual, when we are showing the reader something and letting the reader piece together the pieces themselves instead of telling them what you want them to know. And it also helps if you mirror the opening image in some way. Maybe you put the hero in the same location as the opening image, but now they're behaving differently. Maybe they're holding the same object. Maybe they're encountering the same situation, but now differently. When we can mirror the opening image, we can really show the reader just how far the hero has come and give them the pieces that they need to solve that mystery themselves and see exactly how the hero has transformed. And I say mystery, I don't mean it needs to be a literal mystery, but when the reader gets a glimpse of who your hero is from beginning to end, they can solve the entire puzzle. They can put it together. All right, so in The Girl on the Train, we see Rachel on a train. There's our mirror, and she's riding toward her new life. She's now sober, no longer stuck in the past. So we get our mirror to the opening image is the train ride, and now she's not fantasizing about someone else's life. She's going toward her own new life. So that was a quick overview of The Girl on the Train beat sheet. If you want to read the full beat sheet with all of the details and all of the page counts, you can find that in Save the Cat Writes a Novel. That's one of the 10 books that I break down in entirety in the book. All right, let's look at another beat sheet. Let's put all the beats together and see how they work in a completely different type of novel. This is a young adult sci-fi novel called The Hunger Games. You might have heard of it. If you haven't, you're probably going to be spoiled. But here we go. This is going to be very quick, but hopefully it'll help you put all those pieces together. So, the beat sheet of The Hunger Games. We have an opening image. Katniss wakes up on District 12 on the morning of the reaping. She is poor, often hungry, and thinks solely of keeping her family alive. That is her goal. Her setup, we see Katniss's world of District 12. It's a tough life. She hunts illegally in the woods to make ends meet. She's very protective of her sister Prim, distrustful of most others, which is her flaw. And although she's angry about the injustices of the Capitol, she feels very powerless to do anything about it. You might note that that's going to change by the end, which it should. It is the setup. It is the status quo. And I should note this book does have a save the cat moment. Essentially, Prim brings home, or it's a backstory, but Prim brought home a stray cat. Katniss wanted to kill it because it was another mouth to feed. Prim begged her not to kill it. And what does Katniss do? She saves the cat. Just saying. All right, so the theme stated comes actually a little later in this novel, but Peeta says to Katniss the night before the games, "I keep wishing I could think of a way to show the Capitol that they don't own me, that I'm more than just a piece in their games." And as we already know, Katniss feels powerless against the Capitol. But this theme stated is planting the seed that eventually she will do just that. She will show the Capitol that they don't own her. In the end, this is what she needs to do to transform, show the Capitol they don't own her. Catalyst comes, breaks through the status quo world. It's an epic catalyst. Prim's name is called at the reaping for the Hunger Games. Katniss volunteers to take her place. There's no question about whether Katniss is going to the Hunger Games or not. She's already going. So the debate becomes, can she win? So we see her preparing, essentially. She says goodbye to her family and Gale, who gives her advice on how to win. And then she rides the train to the Capitol, where she starts to get some advice from her new mentor, Haymitch. And then we reach the Capitol at the break into two. The train arrives in this upside down world that is very different from District 12. Peeta waves at the crowd, reminding Katniss that he's already playing the game, and she's very distrustful of him. The B story, though, is Peeta. He declares his love for Katniss on TV, and this is the moment he becomes the love interest. And he helps Katniss earn support that she needs to win the games. He will also help her learn her theme, that to truly win the games, she has to do more than just survive them. Now, the fun and games, we see Katniss receiving a makeover, training for the games, the Hunger Games actually begin, and she struggles with dehydration and burn wounds. She discovers Peeta has allied with the Career Tributes, confirming her suspicion that he can't be trusted. So this is feeling like a downward path for Katniss. And it is. At the midpoint, we have a false defeat. Katniss is chased up a tree by the Careers, where she is surely going to meet her end. But then the stakes are raised and there's a twist. Peeta saves her life, proving that his love for her might not be an act. Interesting. In The Bad Guys Close In, we see an upward path Bad Guys Close In. Despite the fact that she's still in the Hunger Games, she forms an alliance with Rue. They blow up the supplies of the Careers, and things feel like they're getting better for Katniss. But then we reach an All Is Lost, where Rue is caught in a trap and killed. There's our whiff of death. And in The Dark Night of the Soul, Rue's death fuels Katniss's anger toward the Capitol, and she realizes she can do something to defy them. In her Dark Night epiphany, she makes her first rebellious act when she buries Rue in flowers to shame the Capitol. It's her first step toward that theme. At the break into three, though, the game makers announce a rule change. Now two tributes can win if they're from the same district. Katniss calls out Peeta's name, and you sort of notice the mirror to the act break into two. The boy that she vowed not to trust is now her best chance at winning. So in the finale, now she's got to put her plan into action. She has to find Peeta. He's been badly injured, nurse him back to health. They survive until they're the only two left. Then the Capitol announces another rule change. Only one of them can win. Katniss proves she really has learned the theme by threatening to eat the poisonous berries, which would leave the Capitol with no winner, giving up her survival in order to prove that they don't own her. The game makers declare both tributes can win, and in the final image, we see Katniss riding the train home to District 12 with Peeta. She's not just a victor, she's a rebel.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode of Readsy Live, the podcast. You can listen to all our past episodes and subscribe to Readsy Live on Spotify, Apple, or your favorite podcast app. Head to blog.readsy.com/live to find out more about our upcoming live streams, and don't forget to follow us on all our social media accounts. Thanks for listening, and I'll catch you all soon.